This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, and I am so excited. We have a terrific treat today. I have the opportunity to speak from London with a very talented entertainer. He is a writer, producer, and director, but let's just give you an idea how good a writer. He was one of the original main writers for the Gary Shandling Show on TV. He was the writer for Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, Men in Black, Now You See Me 1 and 2, Charlie's Angels, and more recently a drama called Mosaic. Ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to introduce you all to Ed Solomon. Ed, it's been a long time, but you have been a busy, busy boy.
Well, yeah, I kind of have it. It's funny to hear all the whole crowd you have in your house.
They're just excited that I finally got you on the phone. We've been trying to do this for about a year.
I know. I'm sorry. I've been running around. We were shooting in Detroit and then when you first reached out, and now I'm here in London working on this thing. It's been crazy, but it's really nice to talk to you.
Yeah, it's great to catch up. So let's jump into it. So you and I have a relationship through stand-up comedy. My understanding is that around age 19, you were going to UCLA, and you got your first shot on stage. What made you get into comedy? How did it start for you?
My dad and I used to watch these comedies on TV when I was growing up, and I just remember thinking, I wonder how people do that. I never thought you could make a living doing that. And then when I went to UCLA, I went down on the weekend. I went down to UCLA. I was 18 years old, and I arrived on my birthday. I remember 1978. Oh my God. And, my roommate said that the Westwood Comedy Store had open mic night on Monday night. And so I actually went to the comedy store to do a 2-minute set using jokes I'd written in high school. I had one of those bizarre. Yeah, I know. I had one of those bizarre nights. You know how when the crowd's just kind of riding a good wave and you just get there right at the right moment. And I did really well, and I shouldn't have done well. The material wasn't strong enough, but it was just kind of a fluke. And I actually thought to myself, well, I guess I'm going to drop out of school and become a comedian. I actually thought it's pretty silly. I invited everyone that I knew from high school who was at UCLA, like 20 people, to the comedy store the next week to watch me. And I bombed like I should have bombed the first week. You know, it's that thing where you can basically see the words coming out of your mouth and dropping onto the floor. You know, that feeling. It was so humiliating. And I felt worse for the people that had to walk home with me because they didn't know what to say. You know, then I felt even for myself. So I decided no more comedy. I'm never going back into the comedy store. You know, like a typical 18-year-old kid who knows nothing. I thought, if I ever walk back into the comedy store, they'll just all boo me out. You know, like they'd even remember that 2-minute set among 100 2-minute sets. You know,
right.
Anyway, yeah.
I was just going to say that was the perfect way that so many people, I've interviewed over 50 comics, and we all have that experience of bombing. But what's interesting is that first time on stage when you got the great response, you kind of got the bug for the industry, then you bomb. And what really makes somebody resilient in this industry, this art form, is that you go back on stage. So how long did it take you to get back on?
So what happened was, for a year, I was an economics major at UCLA, never going to try comedy, going to go to business school if I'm lucky, or law school, that kind of thing. A girl I had a crush on in high school, Lisa Norcia is her name, is visiting UCLA to see if she wants to go there. And she wants to go to the comedy store with her parents. And I am thinking, oh my God, am I going to go to the comedy store? You know, so I go into the comedy store with her and her parents. Of course, like like, of course, like nobody even remembers. Of course, nobody remembers. I'm just a regular night, and Jimmy Walker is performing.
Oh, good
and
show.
I overhear. Yeah, and I overhear a comedian, Jimmy Alec, who I know you must
oh,
know.
Oh, Jimmy's a great guy. Yeah.
And I overhear him saying to somebody who was asking him if he ever needed writers, saying he wrote his own material, but Jimmy Walker was looking for writers. So then a few sets later, Jimmy Walker goes up on stage and I'm watching it. And that night I was actually thinking, as I was watching comedians, I was thinking, I wonder if I could ever like write this stuff. You know, it seems like it didn't seem that far out of reach to be able to write that stuff. So I go up to Jimmy Walker and I say, in the green room, and I say, I heard you're looking for writers. And he goes, yeah, we're always looking for writers. And he pats me on the head. He gives me a guy named Gene Bronstein, his writing manager or writing head writer, gives me his phone number. I call him. I go back to my dorm room. I called him back to my dorm room. And I type up on that. You know, remember that onion skin typing paper where you could erase, you know, yeah. You know, so I type up on my manual typewriter like 22 jokes and a cover letter that I still have a copy of. Dear Mr. Bronstein, enclosed, please find 22 jokes for your and Mr. Walker's perusal. And I mailed it. And then about 2 weeks later, I got a check for $100 saying Jimmy was buying two jokes and that they don't usually pay that much, but they want to encourage me to write more. That's the moment that I got the confidence back. And so then, you know, per your question, then I noticed there was a thing at UCLA called the UCLA Comedy Club with student comedians. It had just formed. That's when I thought, well, maybe I'll try and get up on stage again. So I started there at the UCLA Comedy Club. And then I was up at my parents who at the time were in Saratoga, California. And I don't remember how or why. I think maybe Barry Sobel had done a UCLA Comedy Club show, because the way the Comedy Club worked was seven or eight student comedians doing like 6 or 7 minutes of material, and then a professional headliner who we'd pay $50 to do a set. We had, you know, I mean, everyone, Gary Shandling, we had George Wallace, we had Jerry Seinfeld. I mean, you name it, we had him for $50 at that time, you know, 1979, 1980, you know, et cetera. So I'm up at my parents, and I believe Barry and I had exchanged phone numbers or something. And he said, Barry, somebody said, I don't know how I ended up at your club in Sacramento. It might have been to see Barry. I don't remember. But I did an audition for you. Would it have been at Last Unlimited?
Yeah.
It must have been, right?
Yeah. And before we get too far ahead, those first jokes you did on stage, do you remember any? Do you remember any of your early writing?
I do. I remember the joke that I told to Jimmy Walker. One was the one that he got a lot of mileage off of was, I just took my driver's test. I can't figure out if it's the pedestrian I hit, which took the points off, or the fact that I hit him in his living room. And that was,
that's actually funny.
I got $50 for it.
I know. That's
the
great
first joke. And then I remember the first time I ever saw anyone perform anything of mine on television. He was doing a TV show called Don Kirshner's Rock Concert, and about 30 people, maybe not that many, maybe 20, jammed into my dorm room. We had this tiny little black and white TV, and at 2 a.m., we watched Jimmy Walker say that joke on that show, and it just blew my mind, like watching a joke I wrote on TV. You know, I remember a ton of jokes like, oh God, there's some terrible ones that, you know.
Oh, the terrible is how we all start.
Yeah, like, I went on a blind date. Well, it didn't start as a blind date, but when she saw me, she put her eyes out. That was from high school. There was a joke. I went on a date. I didn't know I'd drive a license. My dad had to drive me, and the date went great, but it got kind of weird because my dad dropped me off first. And then there was like a bunch of tags to it. I don't quite remember. I got them somewhere, like in my apartment somewhere. I've got actually like all those notebooks with all those early jokes, they're excruciatingly bad overall, you know?
Well, yeah, but you know, there's two things that have come to light. And one is that, you're obviously a talented writer, as all the movies you've worked on has proven. But back in the day, I didn't realize that you were writing for other people, because that's not something everybody can do, because you have to be able to write in the voice of the entertainer that you're writing for. It's not necessarily the same that you would write material for yourself. And the fact that you went from stage to writing back to the stage for yourself probably gave you some lessons and disciplines on the whole, you know, art form and what it takes to create and manufacture a joke. I think that's fascinating. And those early jokes are great, but what great validation to hear them on TV by somebody like Jimmy Walker.
That was wild. That was one of the, you know, highlights of my life. Sometimes people will ask me, like, what's the most interesting, like, what's your favorite moments of hearing something you've written? That is one. And the other one was, I was writing jokes at two, however many decades later, I got to write for a few political candidates for the debates, and trying to write jokes, actual jokes for the debates. You know, the idea was you'd be writing what the candidates would want is a line that had kind of a punch to it, but that could be used out of context in case it was plucked by the media and put without, you know,
right.
any other surrounding material. So I had some terrible experiences, some terrible ones with one candidate, John Kerry. I wrote some jokes for, and he delivered one quite well and one so terribly that it was just really embarrassing to me. But I did have one thing that Barack Obama said, which I thought was, you know, kind of another highlight, but it wasn't actually a joke per se, because he didn't do any of the jokes. Me and a group of friends were writing debate jokes, and he kept never using them, and we just got punchier and punchier as we were going, and crasser and crasser. And, you know, we were writing jokes like, the phone rings at 3 p.m. Who will wake John McCain? We had another one that was like really just racking. So crass, I probably can't even say, but.
Well, you could say anything on the podcast, but yeah, writing for politicians, that's got to be a unique experience.
It was really kind of thrilling to be inside it for a little while and just watch the way they work and the way, you know, their handlers work and stuff. They were a little one-off. I'd like to come in for 6-8 weeks. I did it twice, really, you know, in 2004 and then in 2008 or 12. I don't remember. I did it in 2004 and 2008. One, you know, to what you're saying, to me, I think working on stage, I never would have been like a A-level comedian. You know, maybe if I'd worked as hard on my act, my set, my attitude, all that, as I worked on my writing, maybe, but I was never an innate performer. But being on stage, what it did was it helped me understand that relationship between you and the audience and the nature of communicating to a group of people as opposed to just writing in your own head.
Well, we've jumped way ahead. I'm going to interrupt you and just say we've jumped way ahead, because now you're in the 2000s, and I can't believe you did that, writing for politicians. But going back to when you were about 23, 24, you started to do some stage work, and it sounds like Barry Sobel might have introduced you to the club, or you came up and showcased, because I know that you were an opening act and then a featured act. In fact, I've already used some of your sets for this podcast earlier on, because I recorded a lot of those shows, and you were a terrific writer, but I have to agree that on the performance side wasn't as strong as your writing side. And when did you kind of figure that out?
I knew always, you know, because I think I would describe myself probably as, if you took every comedian who's ever worked and then took the average of them, that would be me. You know, like, I never, if I listened to early tapes of myself doing stand-up, I just wasn't myself. you know, I was just doing what I thought a comedian would do, you know? And so I never got to the place where your true persona comes through and your true angle, your attitude, your true frame of view of the world actually comes out. The thing that makes you really unique and makes, you know, makes you really pop as a comedian, as a presence. I just never got to there. And there were a couple of reasons for that. One was I always wanted to write, and I would often use my set to showcase my jokes, and people would just buy them out from under me, and then I would just not use them anymore. So I mean, that was one reason. And yeah. And I mean, I was 19, Scott, 19 when I auditioned for you. It was February. I remember.
Really?
I auditioned for you at Thanksgiving, I believe, when I was 19, and then February of 1980, I did my first set, my first professional set, the first professional week was up with you. It was literally my first professional gig.
Well, that's awesome, Ed. I sadly don't remember that, but I know that you came in as an opening act, and we liked you right off the bat. I remember working you quite a bit in those early years.
Yeah, I went up a lot. It was actually almost like a home club for me for a while. My first week was Sobel was headlining. Then me, and I think you put me with Barry because I think he introduced me to you, is what I think. I haven't talked to Barry in many, many years. Diane Nichols was the featured act, and I had a really, really interesting experience with her that I have talked about many times to friends, which is it was a microcosm of what show business is, the kind of build the circus tent and, you know, perform in it and then take it down and then, you know, move on. So we had that week, and, you know, at that time I don't remember whether the opening and middle act shared a room or if I stayed, or the opening act was out in the living room. But you know how the club would rent an apartment and then the headliner early had condo, the master bedroom and all that.
Yeah, early condos for comics weren't very exciting, and it would not have been unusual for the opening act to be on the front couch.
Yeah, I think I was on the front couch, especially because Diane was the middle act, so we wouldn't have been sharing the room. But she and I were really, like, we hung out, talked, we had dinner, we'd like, have, you know, drinks after the show, and I was a 19-year-old kid, and I don't know how old, but she was in her probably mid-late 20s. And I thought, wow, I just, you know, we're like, we've been talking, and at the end, you know, on Sunday, I think we were Tuesday to Sunday, right? And I thought, whatever the end of the last night was, I was like, here's my phone number, and I guess I'll see you in L.A. And she just looks at me, and she pats me on the head, and she says, I'll see you down the road.
Because the reality is you were work buddies for a week, but in show business that does not necessarily, you know, form a relationship. And she was being kind and letting you down easy that, you know, I enjoyed hanging with you this week, but you know, I'll call you, don't call me.
but that's the way it is. On movie, you know, I've worked on so many projects where you're out, you know, in some obscure place, living with someone or working with someone really closely, having these intense relationships, doing very, you know, high pressure and often very intense, creative, emotional, vulnerable type of work. And then it ends and you're so certain that you guys are going to be best friends forever and you just don't see them anymore because it was a false scenario. You know, it was a heightened, exaggerated piece of life, and then it's over. And then, you know, that's why I think it's just really important to, you know, have real friends and real family that aren't.
I just think you're sharing with the audience something that has not been brought up before too much, that is a truism when it comes to show business, is that it's a very veneer industry in the sense that everything's intense while you're working together. And, you know, imagine the actors and actresses that have to make out or kiss and they have these huge romantic scenes and then they get off the set and they may never see each other again. I mean, it's just an aspect of the industry that has not been spoken about much, but for us that are in it is so true. And I think it's interesting that Diane, who's a terrific headlining comedian, ended up going on and doing a lot of TV, very successful, was kind in that she was sharing that time with you and helping you as a new comic, but also sharing the reality that it was a 1 week deal.
Yeah, I mean, we never had a physical thing, obviously. It was just friends. I was like, whoa, I made a new great friend. And then it was like, actually, and by the way, she was very friendly and very kind and very empathetic and compassionate and, you know, to me about it. But also, yeah, it sort of let me down easy, like, you know, hey, kid, get used to it. You know, it was nice.
Well, and I'm sure working with Barry Sobel gave you some guidance as far as, because he was a strong headliner, always related well with an audience. I'm sure you were able to pick up some nuances on the industry and maybe even helped your writing by hanging out with people like that.
Oh, tons. I mean, I met so many brilliant, brilliant, brilliant people that I just, to this day, still admire. I remember, you know, you mentioned Bill and Ted. So Chris Matheson and I co-wrote Bill and Ted together. And I just finished a draft. I was on an airplane going to Sacramento, coincidentally, with Bob Saget and his then wife, Sherry, and gave him the script to read on the plane. And I remember we had just set it up. And so now this is like 5 years later. So I started when I was 19. It was the first time I worked up there at last. I got this job on Laverne and Shirley when I was 21. I was a senior in college. So I stopped doing stand-up for about a year. Then I resumed after that again. So I was 24, and it was 1984, I think. And I was flying up Sacramento again to last Unlimited. And with Saget, I worked up there. Shammy, I worked with up there. I worked with, God, I have so many different people. I can't even, it's hard to remember, you know, because also by then I was working at a lot of clubs all around the country and got it. You know, they all sort of blend together after a while. You know how that is.
Well, yeah, but of course, Laughs Unlimited was special.
Well, actually, it was for me because it was my first one. And, you know, I loved the audiences up there. I got, you know, you were terrific. It was a great club to work. It was a really friendly club. You know, a lot of clubs were not really nice to the comedians. Treated sort of like cattle or with a lot of disrespect. You were always really great to the people there. You know, just there was a feeling of, you know, we were welcome. There's a feeling that we were, there was a lot of deep friendships were made. I remember, you know, with other people that worked there. And I remember, you know, yeah, you stayed in touch. Like how many club owners, honestly, you know, are in touch still with people that came through the club? Not a lot. You know, I'm not in touch with any others. To tell you the truth. So I think it was a special place.
Well, some people would say it's friendship. Others would say it's stalking, but you never know.
It is, well, this last year it's been stalking for sure.
And I say, just to get you on the podcast. So you've been working at Laughs. You've been doing some other stage clubs. You had a chance, you mentioned Saget and Shandling and others, Diane Nichols and Barry Sobel that you got a chance to work with at my club. And I think that was a good foundation for your career as a performer and as a writer. What can you share with the audience? What that transition, because you were already writing for other people, was it a slow transition or did you kind of go from performing to being a full-time writer overnight? I mean, how would you explain it?
When I was at UCLA, I was writing plays as well. I was, as I said, an economics major, so I wasn't allowed into any screenwriting classes, but I did get into some playwriting classes. So I wrote some plays. And the third play I wrote was a play called Soup Joint, which I wrote after coming back from, there was a club in Alaska, in Anchorage, Alaska, that, what's his name, Dave? He did with the puppet, Chuck Wood.
All right, Dave Strassman.
Yes, Dave Strassman. And he was booking that club, and so me and two other comics, Jack Grayman, and Robert Aguayo.
Oh, Robert's great comic musician. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Flew up to the strip club. And now I was probably 20 at the time. You know, took a midterm on Thursday, got onto a plane, flew to Anchorage, Alaska to the strip club, which I'd never been inside a strip club before. And imagine like a college kid at a strip club.
That's
sharing
like a candy
a
store.
Room.
Yeah. That's crazy.
Bonkers. I remember first set I go, I do. People are buying me shots of schnapps. I'm drinking schnapps. I walk off. A stripper takes you off stage, which is, you know, you're in college. It's craziness. She says to me, "Do you do toot?" I don't know what that means. It means cocaine, obviously, but I didn't know what it meant. I said, "Yes." And then she and then she says, "Do you want to come party with me as my boyfriend?" And I had this weird idea that I'd wind up face down in the snow somewhere in Alaska. So I ended up not, thankfully. But I just that event was really a kind of shocker for me. So I came back and I wrote a play called Strip Joint, which was originally about a guy who goes to New York for some reason or other. But he does stand up to do stand up, and he ends up working in a strip club. And then I ended up changing it to a guy who goes to New York because he's a prodigy musician, and he ends up playing piano at a strip club because it was a little more theatrical, and had this play performed at UCLA.
Oh, how cool.
And yeah, that at that time I had already been writing for Gary Shandling. So because Gary had done one of the UCLA Comedy Club shows when I met him and invited me to write with him. So I started really writing a lot with Gary, for Gary's set. And Gary introduced me to a guy named Mark Stockton, who was a friend of his, who was a producer on Laverne and Shirley. And Mark came to see that play. So he came to that play, and I had given Mark like a bunch of jokes that I'd written and sold. Better jokes than the first ones we talked about, you know, jokes that I'd been, right. You know, like a few years later, you know. And that combination, he said, he hired me as a staff writer on Laverne and Shirley. So my senior year of UCLA, my last half of it, I just never went to class. I just went to Paramount Studios.
What year would that be, Ed? That had to be early 80s.
82. I was 21 years old. It was 1982. And it was really hard. I truly, you know, I was okay at that job. I wasn't great at it. I was good enough to not get fired. I wasn't good enough to continue on in the sitcom world after that, because it was too stressful for me. And I just wasn't the kind of joke writer that those professional TV writers are, you know, that can just crank out joke after joke after joke at that really high level.
I had a chance to interview Lois Bromfield, who lives in Germany now, and she was one of the head writers for the Roseanne show. And also I interviewed Karen Anderson, and both these ladies were TV sitcom writers. In fact, Karen still does it. She's working on a project with Sean Hayes. But they were so clear to explain how much work it is, and that sometimes they'd have 12, 14-hour days or you know, were told to fix something immediately. The stress was incredible.
It was horrifying. I was not, you know, I just didn't have the constitution for it, really. And it was too green. And, you know, I remember first week, we were doing a show a week, and we'd be up till 2, 3 a.m. every night rewriting. You know, it was craziness. And I remember the first week, Mark Stockton comes in and he says, "Okay, every day from 3 to 3:30, we're going to do nap time. Just everything's quiet. We're going to, you know, everyone's going to just take a break, kind of take a nap, because we're going to be having to work pretty late." And years later, I bumped into one of the head writers of that show, not Mark, another guy who's unfortunately no longer alive. And he had treated me really terribly on the show. He was really resentful that I was this young guy, and he was really mean to me. You know, like, he'd walk down the hall and I'd say, you know, "Hey, you know," I won't say his name, "and, you know, do you have the time?" And he'd say, "Yes, Ed, I do," and keep walking. And I bumped into him at Dupar's in LA one day, and I said, "How are you doing?" You know, we sat down and I said, "How are you doing?" And then we were talking, and, you know, he was pretty mellowed out, and we ended up talking about meditation of all things, because I had started meditating, and it would have been awesome if I, you know, had the meditation practice back then, because I would have had something to do at nap time besides just lie on my couch unable to sleep, me being terrified I was going to get fired. And he's like, "What nap time? What are you talking about?" I said, "Nap time. Remember, like, it was like you or Mark or somebody announced that every day from 3 to 3:30 we're shutting down, no phone calls, we're just doing nap time. And he's like, I don't know what you're talking about. I said, nap time. I'd lie on my couch, paranoid, terrified, that and then I'd come back in after nap time, and everyone would have napped, and they had all this energy. And he's like, he looks at me, he goes, we weren't napping, we were doing coke.
Really? They called it nap time. Oh, that's funny.
Well, not Mark. Mark wasn't. It was like some of the writers from the show, I guess, were just doing coke. And then I was always wondering, like, why do they have so much energy? They must have been napping so well. Again, me and the no idea about coke.
Yeah, but it's just so. It's I hate to say it, and this is not condescending, but it's kind of cute that in the naiveness of your age and in early career, that all this stuff is going on, nap time, and you're totally clueless until years later. Did you figure it out?
Well, what's funny too is, so the next television show I worked on was Gary's show, as you say, it's Gary Shandling's show. And because I lived really close to where we were shooting, at the break after we do the run through, while Gary and Alan were getting the notes and stuff, I would go back to my apartment in Silver Lake, and I would go for a run around Silver Lake, and then I would come back into the office, and I'd be all flushed and red. And one of the other writers on the show years later said to me, when I said, he asked me what I used to do, why I'd leave. And I say, you know, I'd run around Silver Lake. And he looked at me, he goes, I swear to God, we all thought you were doing coke.
He thought it was nap time again.
Yeah, exactly. Pretty funny. I really did not think, Scott, that this conversation would be coke themed, but apparently it is.
Well, it's just interesting that we, in the early 80s, it's no surprise to anybody that's over 40 years of age that in the 80s, cocaine was a pretty prevalent tool for people in entertainment. And, you know, we had a no drugs, no excessive drinking rule at my club, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. And in fact, there was a funny story where John Fox chased me around the green room with a spoonful of coke trying to get me to try it. And I just wasn't into that kind of stuff. It scared the heck out of me. The fact that you were in deep in the industry as a writer doing sitcoms, which have really strenuous situations, long hours, it's no surprise that drugs or some sort of stimulant was prevalent. And it just shows to your youth and inexperience at the time that you weren't aware of it. But now you're writing for the Gary Shandling Show. We both had an opportunity to spend a lot of time with Gary. He was a genius writer, great performer, ended up doing lots of TV and movies. How did you transition from the Gary Shandling Show to movies like Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure? Was that an easy step? I know you'd already been working on the script, but trying to sell it, that can be difficult.
When we actually started writing it in 83, and we set it up in 84, and then it got put in turnaround by Warner Brothers in 85, and it kind of sat on the shelf. And then I started working on Gary's show, and then the script got picked up again, and the movie got greenlit in 87. And so I remember leaving Gary's show for a little bit to go do Bill and Ted, and then coming back on to Gary's show. And then the movie got shelved, and then it got purchased again by someone else, and they put some more money and re-edited it, added a scene or two, and then it finally got released in 89. So that was a kind of checkerboard version of, it didn't just kind of happen overnight, but it took a long time to get that movie out. But once that movie... Oh, go for it.
I was just going to say that it's interesting because I don't think a lot of people realize that when you go out and see a movie, you know, they're thinking, oh, well, it got shot, you know, the year before, and it was written maybe the year before that. But a lot of successful films have trouble getting started, or can take years, sometimes a decade, to get from pen to script to movie to the screen. And it is a arduous process. And I was asking, was there a transition between TV and movie? But much like several other types of Hollywood projects, it's all kind of overlapping, right? You're kind of always working on something, hoping that something you worked on previously goes.
100%. And now, I mean, my life now, I'm 61 years old. I was 19, Scott, when you and I met. I'm 61. Now I've got so many things that I've been working on for so long, and a lot of them overlap. Sometimes I've got three or four things happening at one time. And, you know, it's bonkers. At the time then, it was, you know, that was, there were things overlapping early on, but it was only, I wasn't working on a lot of different things. I had Bill and Ted, I had Gary Shandling, you know, show. And just the nature of the process led to an overlap. I have found that I have had to always have a lot of different irons in the fire creatively, just, you know, because you just never know if something's going to work or not work creatively. You don't know if someone's going to want to make it or buy it. You don't know if you'll get it right, which is a lot of the problems, because it takes a while to get something right. A lot of scripts. Men in Black was 4 years of fairly agonizing work before it got made. Bill and Ted, we started in 83 and came out in 89. Bill and Ted Face the Music took us 14 years to get made. While at the same time, I had a movie out last year that I'm really proud of, a movie called No Sudden Move, which was on HBO Max. I had talked to the director, Steven Soderbergh, who did Mosaic that you had mentioned, and he and I started talking about No Sudden Move in December. I don't remember which year, but in December. In February, I did an outline. In October, we were shooting it, and that was with a COVID delay. We were supposed to shoot even sooner, and it was out the next year in the late spring, early summer. So that was a super fast one. Unusually fast.
That one went fast. But let me interject something to just ask you if it's a truism. I think it is. But wasn't the fact you'd already written for Laverne and Shirley and the Gary Shandling Show, you that's writing for television or cable, and then you get, finally, it took years, but you got Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure at least off the page and onto film. It maybe took a few years to release, but you got it made. Isn't it true in show business, like a lot of other businesses, you almost have to prove yourself before people will trust you? Because I'm assuming, and you tell me if I'm correct or not, that once you got your first movie produced and out there, did it make it easier to sell yourself for things like Men in Black and Now You See Me and Charlie's Angels? Does it kind of pick up speed, momentum on the writing side?
Yes, it can. But I think the best work I've done is the work that, for the most part, that I've written on spec. The first 10 years of my career, I was writing mostly on spec. Bill and Ted was on spec. Shandling Show worked on spec. I wrote a bunch of somewhat bad spec scripts in the early years. And then once, you know, Bill and Ted's success got me into the studio hireability, I guess, market. And as you're saying, Men in Black, when that came out, that put me into a different level where I was getting a lot of stuff coming at me, job offers and stuff. And I think for about 10 years, I took a lot of jobs that in hindsight, wish I hadn't taken, you know, jobs that I knew would get made, which is why I took the job, as opposed to jobs that I felt really personally connected to as much. I think it's a bigger version of what I was talking about earlier in terms of my stand-up. I didn't really know myself that well, and I was allowing other people's opinions of me or my resume to kind of give me hints as to who I might be, as opposed to meeting with just what means something to me. The last decade or more, even, I've had more things made in the last 10 years than I've ever had, certainly in terms of page count, but most of it's been started as spec work. Again, this thing that I'm working on now that shoots in September, the reason, unfortunately, I've been so busy, and, you know, we've had to kind of reschedule this a couple times, this thing called Full Circle. I started in 2016, and it was a 642, I think, pages spec script. You know, that I spent years on spec because it just, you know, at a certain point, I'm not a writer who's ever, you know, taken job or money or not taken job because of money. You know, I've always, even in those 10 years, 15 years when people were bringing me a lot of stuff, I always tried to do something that I thought I could do well, you know, and jobs that, but, you know, I, and even if I thought, well, this one will get made, I wouldn't do it unless I thought I could really do it.
You wanted something that you could connect with.
Yeah, you know, and you want, you know, they didn't always end up good, or, you know, I often was rewritten or fired, or, you know, or I couldn't get it right and movie sucked and, you know, it's my fault, or sometimes it was someone else's fault, sometimes it was a combination. But the last 10, 12 years, I've done a little bit of comedy, but I've kind of veered away from doing comedy because I think it's really hard as an older person to be funny. It's not just that the culture changes. It requires a kind of energy, that I don't have, a kind of mind, a kind of state of mind that's very difficult to maintain. And, you know, so for about the last 25 years, I've been trying to build skills that would allow me to work in a more different genres. And it took a lot of failure, honestly, to get to a place where I could, you know, I could actually write in a lot of different milieu and genres.
Well, I think that that's fascinating, and we talked about it way earlier that in comedy, you have to fail to succeed. I'm an entrepreneur. I will tell anybody that wants to get into business, you're going to fail to succeed. It's failures are the stepping stones to success, as Emmett Stone said. But let me ask two things. One is very generic, but for the audience, can you, in a short term, explain the difference between, let's say, a script, a treatment, and a spec job? Just on generic stuff.
Well, spec is short for speculative, and that means nobody's paying you for it. So whatever you're writing and then going to hope to sell or hope to get made somehow.
So you're creating a product to sell. Okay.
Yeah, you're creating something and you're taking it as far as you can take it on your own. And most of the things, you know, Bill and Ted Face the Music was a spec script that Chris and I wrote, even though we didn't even own it at that point. We just wanted to get it right creatively. Mosaic was spec until HBO picked it up. No Sudden Move, which is the Soderbergh one I talked about, that was spec. But I knew I had Steven, so it wasn't as big a risk because Steven was developing it with him. But it was on spec. Full Circle, this new thing, spec, that thing that took me years and years to do, that shoots later. A treatment is something bigger than an outline and less than a full script. It, you know, an outline is what it sounds like. It's an outline. It can be anywhere from 2 pages to 20 pages. A treatment is something that's usually 15 to 40 pages. It's like a, you're describing everything that's happening, but you're not really getting into the dialogue and the specifics.
Right, right. You're laying out the concept of what you picture as the film or the show you're working on.
Yeah, and as a writer, a professional writer, you can get work in a lot of different ways. You can write on spec. You know, somebody can come to you with an idea. A producer came to me with Men in Black. There were 3 issues of a comic book. I didn't think it was something I could write because it was really serious and it was about kind of demons and it was very different than what the movie became. And in my note to the producer about why I didn't think I could do it, but what I could do, I think, they said, hey, what if you did the version that you think you could do? And, you know, so that sometimes people can come to you with stuff. Sometimes people will pitch an idea to try to get paid to write. And by that, it means meet with a studio executive of some kind and try and tell them an idea and entice them to pay you to write it. I've only done that a couple times because I just am not a good pitcher and I don't like the process. And usually I don't like the power position it puts you in. And I also just don't like having to go to someone saying, please hire me. I prefer to go, hey, I've written this.
Right. Who would right.
be interested in it?
Yeah. Is you know? It, from the creative aspect, I could see it would be more rewarding, although much more risky, to spend time writing scripts on spec and hoping that it goes somewhere. But in short, for the audience, the difference between on spec and being a paid script writer is that difference is that on one, you're doing it on your own time, hoping to sell it. And on the other, as a paid writer, of course, Saturday Night Live or the Gary Shandling Show or whatever it is, you're hired to write. And it's a job that you're getting paid for as opposed to spec, which is, as you said, speculative. It's a gamble. Will anybody want it? The other thing I wanted to point out, and I'm not going to take up too much more of your time, Ed. I really appreciate it. But I have been such a huge fan of your movies. And I have to be honest, I wasn't even aware that you had written all of them. But Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure, Men in Black, Now You See Me is one of my popular I love those. Charlie's Angels, all very fun, entertaining, energetic, you know, exciting movies. Then you, as you said, with age, you've transitioned to Mosaic and some of the projects you're working on now. You alluded to it, but let me ask specifically, it sounds like it's easier, but how did you find it going from comedy to drama?
Comedy, let there be no mistake. Comedy's hard. It's actually harder in a lot of ways because in a comedy, you have to do everything you do in drama and also be funny. And I think you were talking about transitions from TV to film, joke writing to TV, for you know, and that kind of thing earlier. The reason I think it's hard for people to transition from being stand-up to sitcom is that sitcom requires a certain higher level of reality, but it's not as high a level of reality as a certain film type usually is. Sometimes people have a tough time transitioning from sitcom to film. Sometimes people have a tough time transitioning from comedy to drama or from drama to comedy, or you know, they don't bridge those too well. For me, I just knew that I couldn't get to the level of comedy as I was getting older that I would have wanted to be able to get to in order to do work that I was proud of. Certainly not the levels of comedy that people I got to work with could achieve. There were people, I mean, you know, they came through your club that you know them. Some people that can just get to that joke or that idea in a way that just seems like magic, you know, how do they do that? I just never had that good a sense of humor. I couldn't get there. I also had a lot broader interest. And to be totally honest, I'm ambitious. And I didn't want to be in my 50s and having to beg for work or have people throw me bones. So I knew that the comedy road would dry up or at least not be as fruitful. And I was going to have to really develop other skills in order to be able to continue working. And you were talking about failure as a stepping stone. I honestly would not have had any of the success I had I not had some really brutal, painful failures that taught me the bigger lesson. I mean, you learn so much more from failure than you do from success. Something successful, you get a lot of accolades, but you never look back and go, huh, you know, what did I do that made that work? In fact, the mistake is often going, what did I do that made it work? Because then people try to repeat themselves in success. But with failure, if you are able to go, where did I blow it? And if you're able to pull yourself up and keep going, which, by the way, is a lot harder than it might seem, or, you know, it's really hard to do. If you're able to truly learn from your mistakes and then keep going, those failures actually make you grow so much more. In fact, I can look at every success I have and point very clearly to a failure that I wouldn't have had the success without. Either I changed the direction or I made a relationship or I learned a big lesson or whatever it is. So back to your question about comedy and drama, it's a sliding scale to me. You know, I don't think humor ever hurts anything, but you know, what's important is if you're writing a thriller, it's thrilling. A horror film is it's terrifying. If you're writing a comedy, it's funny. If you're, you know, or you're writing some blend of those things, you have to be able to look at what the essential core is of the thing you're writing. What I'll use a pretentious word, whatever the itness of it is, what is it trying to tell you it is? What is the best evocation of this idea? And then be of service to that. What is the idea trying to tell you it wants to be? And how? What is your relationship with the idea that is both coming out of you, but also you're paying attention to in the same way that you maybe look at a kid, that you have a child and like I had two kids. I had the first kid, I thought, oh, this is what kids are. And then once I had a second kid, I was like, oh, I was completely wrong. These things are, each child is very different and they require very different things. And you to be a good parent to that child requires paying very close attention to how do you help this child become the best, manifestation of themselves. And I think it's the same with writing. You know, what is the best version of this idea? How can this idea be best told? And how can I not have my own ego attached to it in a way that if someone rejects it or doesn't like it, that I don't feel like they're rejecting me, but rather what I tried to make. And then how do I look at the thing I made and make it better? And that's a really hard thing to do. So I don't think it's so much about comedy versus drama. I just think it's what's on the sliding scale. You know, what is the right place for this thing?
Well,
I
mean, it obviously you're a tremendous artist and tremendous gifted writer. And I'm asking simplistic questions to something that may be difficult to explain, but I think you did a great job and I appreciate you doing that. Now, before I let you go, I'm going to do a little name dropping. I know that once you write a script, you have no idea who's going to be performing the material that you write. But just real quick, you know, you put words in the mouth of Sharon Stone, Keanu Reeves, Paul Rubens, Beau Bridges, Woody Harrelson, Morgan Freeman, Daniel Radcliffe, Michael Caine, Eddie Murphy, Holly Hunter, Billy Bob Thornton, Annette Bening, Will Smith, Tommy Lee Jones, Cameron Diaz, Drew Barrymore, Lucy Liu, and hundreds of others. It has to be, I mean, I'm just thrilled thinking about it. You must just have a great sense of success or confidence from these people speaking your words.
That's wild to hear that. You know, it's really wild to hear those names and think about that. It's, I wouldn't say confidence, but I would say it is, I never take it for granted. And it is always amazing. Like always amazing. That moment we were talking about earlier about watching Jimmy Walker say a joke. I feel it every day when I'm on set with anything I ever do. I can't believe it. Like I can't believe it. I will stand there thinking this is amazing. My girlfriend is a writer. She's a phenomenal writer and she's got a show going right now that just started yesterday. And we're having this exact conversation today, in text, just like, she's like, this job is amazing. Like I'm standing next to somebody who's my good friend and she's saying lines that I wrote and I am, you know, and I'm saying, I know, isn't this, it's just remarkable. It makes no sense. There's nothing more thrilling than, by the way, with having a great actor say your words, because two things happen. One, they make them sound better. And two, you grow because when your words go through their, whatever you want to call it, instrument, their art, their, you know, them, first of all, their questions are at a deeper level. Their notes are at a deeper level. And what you realize you can accomplish with a look or a way of saying something by a really talented person just makes you, for the next time, a little bit better. You can write in a more nuanced way, a deeper way, a more complex way. So, I mean, it's weird to hear you say all those names. It's a trip for me. I can't believe it, really. It still feels weird. It doesn't give me more confidence, but it does make me feel more kind of amazed, actually.
Yeah, and you stated exactly what I was thinking, that if you had the thrill of hearing your jokes being told on TV, imagine the exhilarating feeling it would be to have people of this stature, these artists, taking your words and making them their own, I think is quite an accomplishment. And I got to tell you, Ed, it's been a real privilege to have you on this podcast. I've had a chance to work with some of the best in the business, but by far, you're the only featured act that ended up being a huge success in this way. And I mean that with all joy that it was to get a chance to work with you, share some of those early years with you. We had you back over and over at Laughs Unlimited because we not only realized you're a gifted writer and performer, but you know, you're a good guy. And that is proven again today by the fact that you took this time while in London, of all places, to share this moment with me and the audience. I do want to share this podcast is all about stand-up comedy and the history of the business. And I am going to share some of your stand-up material from when you were 23, 24 years old. So that'll be tacked on to the end of this. So, ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned.
But as long as I don't have to listen to it, knock yourself out.
And for you, sir, thank you for all the great work you've done and sharing your mind and your writings through these various films and TV shows. Has been a real gift because what's amazing is long after we're gone, these will be around and you should be, I'm proud of what you've accomplished. And I know you feel pride in what you've been able to give not only to the industry, but the accomplishments that you've achieved yourself. Congratulations.
Hey, thank you so much. And thank you for having faith in me early on. I mean, it really is a meaningful thing for me. And that time there was huge for me and I really appreciate it. And thanks for having me on today. And thanks for what you were saying. And to whoever's listening, thank you for that too.
Well, we appreciate you, Ed. Ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned. I'm going to share a little stand-up comedy from Mr. Solomon and keep an eye out. Oh, real quick before we go, 2023, what project should we be looking for?
I got this thing called Full Circle.
Full Circle, okay.
Another Soderbergh thing. It'll be on HBO Max. It's a limited series that was, and then I've got a show right after that on Amazon. Called Little Rock. That presumably will be out then. And but that's the next thing going is this thing called Full Circle that I'm super hopeful. I just did a giant rewrite of it, and I feel really hopeful about it. I'm super excited. And
all right. Well, ladies and gentlemen,
that should be out.
I was just going to say, ladies and gentlemen, keep an eye out for Full Circle and Little Rock, right? I got those right?
Yes. Little Rock, they haven't greenlit or anything yet. I'm still writing the pilot. So, if I do my job, that'll be after that. If I don't do my job well, you won't see it. And it'll be because I didn't deliver it.
Yeah. Well, we'll just keep our fingers crossed and keep an eye out for Ed Solomon as the head writer and producer and directed. You've done all kinds of amazing things. Thank you so much for being here today. Ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned for some stand-up comedy by Ed Solomon. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Scott. Thanks for having me on.
All really right. Fun. Ladies and gentlemen, here we go. Stand-up comedy by Ed Solomon.
Anyone get Trivial Pursuit? Yeah. Oh, there's a good game. So I don't understand the concept of this game. It's like pay like $39.95 to feel like an idiot. It's like, because how come it's like every question you get is like geography. What is the exact latitude and longitude of Bengal? And then like your opponent always gets questions like geography. What planet are we on? Oh man. Did anyone have Christmas dinner at home and all that stuff? Anyone have things? Same thing like Thanksgiving dinner at home. It's always the same thing. Now, is it just me? I don't think so. I'm 24 now. When I go home for like Thanksgiving dinner and stuff, they still stick me at the kiddie table. Do you know what I'm talking about? It's like the aluminum card table. They like throw a sheet over it. You put your elbow on it, everything like slides down to where... And every year they tell you, when you grow up, you move up from the kiddie table to the adult table. When you grow up, yeah, that's bullshit, okay? Let's face it, folks. The only way you move up from the kiddie table to the adult table is if someone at the adult table dies. Sad but true. I'm sitting there going, Grandpa, boo! And my mom's there. My mom's drinking. Like, you know people like this? She won't drink from the same glass someone else uses. But, like, she will French kiss the dog. It's like... I say, right, Mom, well, the dog was in the house using the water pick, okay? I was outside eating dog shit, okay? So we're at the table, we're at the dinner table, right? And it, like, when I was a kid, it was like the adults would drink, like, wine and champagne, and they'd give the kids sparkling cider. Did you ever had sparkling cider? Like, this is supposed to think we're really drinking wine, right? And have, like, four or five glasses go out and drive our big wheel off a cliff or something. Moron. Does anyone who drinks and drives here? Anybody? You do? Drinking and driving is a problem. Oh, I mean, it's not a problem if you're drunk, because like if you're drunk, hell, you know you can drive. The problem comes to the person who has to basically convince you that you're too drunk to drive. You always end up with like, Dave, you're a little messed up right now. Maybe I should drive you home. Dave says, no, I'm fine. Just let me adjust the seat. I say, Dave, you're sitting on the fucking hood of the car right now. Okay? But I actually have a solution for the drunk driving problem that would eradicate it 100% from the freeway. And I don't know why they haven't instigated it yet. Why don't we simply do this? Why don't we simply put on the freeway a drunk lane? You know. Thank you. Sort of a padded lane, sort of shaped like this. Cars just kind of... I'm going to read you an honest-to-God question from the California driver's test, and I want you to tell me if you think this is not possibly one of the most difficult things you've ever seen. Question number one, honest question. What does this sign mean? No right turn. A... No right turn. B. Deer crossing. C. Turn left into the oncoming traffic. I missed this one. I put none of the above. I was some of these are incredible. Like, what do you think? Okay. Number two. That's three. Two. Driving under the influence of any drug which makes you drive unsafely is A, fun. B, okay on weekends. But watch out for those roadblocks. And of course C, okay, but you must be willing to share it with everyone on the freeway. Yeah, okay. How about this one? Number three, pedestrians using guide dogs or carrying white canes. A, should be ignored, they're just trying to attract attention. B, should be considered armed and extremely dangerous. And of course, C, are blind, drive by and yell, how many fingers am I holding up?
That was Ed Solomon live on stage from back in 1984. And what's really interesting is we were recording that show for an album, that's right, a comedy album that we released called Assorted Nuts Live from Laughs Unlimited that was launched in 1985. It featured Dana Carvey, John Fox, Robert Aguayo, and Ed Solomon, along with others. It was a lot of fun to produce the album. It was great having Ed on our live stage back in those days. But just think about it. He went on to produce, direct, and most importantly, be a major scriptwriter for some of the top films of our lifetime. And it's important to remember it all started from stand-up comedy. And I think that's the takeaway that I have from all this, is that stand-up comedy offers so much enrichment in the arts that it can lead to so many amazing things. And of course, in the case of Ed Solomon, he's been truly successful, and it was just a real blessing to get him on this podcast. Hey, I really enjoyed doing this one. Next week, we have another great show. Be sure to tell your family and friends and share the podcast. Thanks for listening. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.